the nuclear accident in Japan may undermine support for nuclear power here in the U.S. If it does, other sectors of the energy economy stand to benefit, none more than the natural gas industry. So the Japanese disaster could speed development of a huge natural gas reserve that sits below some of the most populous states on the East Coast. It's called the Marcellus Shale. NPR's Joel Rose reports.
A few years ago, this hilltop in northeastern Pennsylvania was forest and farmland. Today, it's a brand new industrial site, a collection of pipes and compressors that help move natural gas from local wells to market.
We're standing at the Lathrop Compressor Station right now. There's about 75 wells behind this particular station and plans to double that over the next couple of years.
Michael Dickinson is a manager for Williams. The company operates two compressor stations in Pennsylvania with plans to add three more. And it's building a new 30-mile stretch of pipeline to transport natural gas on to Philadelphia and New York City. Dickinson and I watch while contractors in hard hats and overalls weld big sections of steel pipeline together.
Those pipelines are kind of like the railroads are to the coal industry or the highline wires are to the electricity industry. We have to have those pipelines, that infrastructure, to get this gas to the place that it can be used.
Natural gas is booming in the Marcellus Shale, which runs from Kentucky to upstate New York. And problems halfway around the world at the Fukushima nuclear plant may only add to that growth. Energy experts say the U.S. and other countries will likely put the brakes on plans for additional nuclear power plants, at least in the short run.
The big beneficiary here will be natural gas.
Daniel Juergen is the chairman of Cambridge Energy Research Associates, an energy consulting company. Natural gas is relatively clean and cheap to burn, says Juergen, while environmental regulations in the U.S. make new coal plants unlikely. And renewable power sources like wind just aren't ready to satisfy the demand for electricity.
Natural gas now has become much more competitive as a source of new electric generation in the United States. That was true before the nuclear accident. It is even more true after the accident.
Pennsylvania's new governor is eager to exploit the state's gas reserves. Here's Republican Tom Corbett in his budget address last month.
Let's make Pennsylvania the Texas of the natural gas boom. I'm determined that Pennsylvania not lose this moment.
Corbett says Pennsylvania needs the thousands of new jobs the gas industry promises. But the issue is increasingly divisive. In order to get gas out of the ground, drillers have to use a process known as hydraulic fracturing or fracking. That produces lots of wastewater, which critics fear will contaminate drinking water supplies. Director Josh Fox talks about those concerns in his controversial Oscar-nominated documentary, Gasland.
You're probably saying to yourself, that's insane. That water contains all the fracking chemicals, which are toxic, and all the volatile organics, which are also toxic.
Natural gas industry and state regulators denounced Gasland as misleading and one-sided. But those who study the industry say you can't dismiss the film's claims entirely. David Yoxheimer is a hydrogeologist at Penn State University.
The industry in earnest is trying to do the right thing in, you know, most cases. Now, have there been some unfortunate environmental incidents? No doubt about it. So what we need to do is make sure we do have the proper regulations in place, make sure the companies are using the best available technologies.
For now, regulators in New York have put a moratorium on new gas wells while they study the environmental impact. In Pennsylvania, Governor Corbett created a commission to explore whether new regulations are necessary. But the commission may have to work fast because no one expects the natural gas industry to wait. Joel Rose, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. One thing to remember about the budget drama here in Washington is that by congressional standards, there is still plenty of time. Much of the government shuts down at the end of this work week if lawmakers don't agree on a budget, but of course it is only Wednesday. Lawmakers do tend to push up to or beyond their deadlines. This is all part of larger battles to come as the White House and Capitol Hill negotiate the budget. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
President Obama says Democrats and Republicans are closer than ever to an agreement on a budget for the current fiscal year. He's pushing lawmakers to finalize a deal, saying the last thing the U.S. economy needs now is the disruption of a government shutdown.
We don't have time for games. We don't have time for trying to score political points or maneuvering or positioning. Not on this.
The president hosted a meeting with top lawmakers at the White House yesterday, but they left without an agreement. House Speaker John Boehner said afterwards Republicans won't be boxed in to accepting a budget that doesn't meet their demands.
We've made clear that we're fighting for the largest spending cuts possible. We're talking about real spending cuts here, no smoke and mirrors.
The president says Democrats have already agreed to cut spending by some $33 billion, equal to what some Republicans, including Boehner, originally asked for. Mr. Obama said he would call lawmakers back to the White House today for another round of negotiations.
And if that doesn't work, we'll invite them again the day after that.
One reason for the president's impatience is that this budget battle is something of a sideshow. The cuts are concentrated in the discretionary, non-defense part of the budget, which represents only 12% of federal spending. To make a serious dent in the deficit, lawmakers will have to tackle the big-ticket items like defense and Medicare.
There are going to be, I think, very sharply contrasting visions in terms of where we should move the country. That's a legitimate debate to have. By the way, part of the reason that debate's going to be important is because that's where 88% of the budget is.
House Republicans tried to launch that larger debate yesterday by introducing their version of a 2012 budget. Paul Ryan, who chairs the House Budget Committee, says their plan would cut trillions of dollars in federal spending over the next decade while lowering the top corporate and individual tax rates to 25%.
It is a plan to give our children a debt-free nation so they, too, can realize their American dream.
Ryan's plan doesn't eliminate the debt or even balance the annual federal budget for decades. The plan's biggest spending cuts come in government health care programs. Under Ryan's plan, people under 55 today could no longer expect open-ended Medicare coverage when they retire a decade from now. Instead, they'd get a fixed government subsidy to buy private insurance, with the money going directly to the private insurer. Ryan's plan's modeled on one developed by Bill Clinton's former budget director, Alice Rivlin. She says the subsidy could save the government a lot of money.
The government would then be able to control the amount of the subsidy or the growth of the subsidy. Right now, Medicare is a fee-for-service system, and the government just has to pay the bills, whatever they are.
Critics warn that the subsidies won't keep pace with rising health care costs, leaving seniors to pay more and more of their own medical bills. Ryan is counting on competition among those private insurers to help keep costs in check.
The question with health care going forward is either health care is going to be run by 30,000 bureaucrats in Washington with command and control and price controls, or 300 million Americans acting as consumers demanding performance and competition among doctors, hospitals, insurers for our business.
But before that issue is joined, lawmakers will face another deadline more ominous than Friday's threatened government shutdown. Next month, the government will exhaust its authority to borrow money unless Congress agrees to raise the debt ceiling. Some lawmakers are balking at that. But Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner warns failure to do so would be catastrophic.
Default by the United States would precipitate a crisis worse than the one we just went through. I think it would make the crisis we went through look modest in comparison.
So this week's budget showdown is just one in a series of fiscal fights, testing whether Washington's divided government can, in Geithner's words, actually solve problems, not just talk about them. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The government of Greece needs to raise tens of billions of dollars to avoid defaulting on its debt. It's going to raise most of it by selling real estate. And that has some Greeks worried the deal could turn into a fire sale of Greece's national treasures. Joanna Kakissis reports from Athens.
It's a spring evening and the tree-lined walkway below the Acropolis is filled with people. One is Eleni Moscha, a 22-year-old university student. She's heard that German politicians want Greece to sell the Acropolis and some islands to pay off more than $400 billion in debt.
I don't think that we should sell things like our islands or ancient stuff, because this is our national heritage and it's really important for tourism as well, because if we sell this, we have nothing, practically.
Economist Yanis Tournadas calls talk of an Acropolis sale silly, bad-taste humor. He's been promoting selling less controversial land for years. Lots of it is ripe for investment, he says.
We talk about real estate in certain parts of the country, either close to the sea or in mountains or in cities, which is totally underdeveloped now. It stays idle.
Polls show Greeks are divided about selling state assets. The government cut spending and hiked taxes in exchange for international loans last year to avoid default. But the cost-cutting has also worsened the recession and increased unemployment. For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Athens.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Japanese automaker Toyota has had to suspend production since the March 11th earthquake and tsunami. The impact is being felt acutely in Toyota City, Japan, where the company is based. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports that many small manufacturers there survived by selling parts to Toyota, and the shutdowns are already hurting the local economy.
At Okuda Industries, a machine pours molten aluminum from something that looks like a large ladle and then stamps it into a mold. The company makes metal parts for transmissions, brake systems, and engines, parts that eventually make their way to Toyota factories, including one in West Virginia. The company's president is 56-year-old Kiyohito Okuda, whose family started the company more than half a century ago.
We have grown as Toyota has grown, and as the auto industry has boomed.
Okuda Industries is one of hundreds of small companies in the area whose fate is tied directly to the health of the giant automaker. Okuda says, in one sense, companies like his have been relatively fortunate. Since March 11th, this city, more than 200 miles south of Tokyo, has been spared the energy shortages and transportation bottlenecks that have plagued other parts of Japan.
This area is really far away from the disaster zone. It's strange to say it, but it almost feels like that happened in another country.
Still, right after the disaster, he says, Toyota stopped placing orders because of production problems, and Okuda's company, which employs 120 people, had to shut down for nearly a week. Production has slowly returned, but orders still aren't what they were.
In the past, when Toyota stopped production, it was only for a week or so, and it was much more gradual. This interruption in production happened suddenly and has lasted almost a month, so this is a big concern for us.
Other companies in Toyota City have fared even worse. The local Chamber of Commerce surveyed parts manufacturers. Many say they have had to curtail production because of the Toyota slowdown or because they've had trouble getting raw materials and supplies. And the chamber's Yasutaka Kato says that's being felt all over the area.
Toyota is a key industry around here, so when it slows production, it affects everything. People stop going out and spending money. Business people stop coming to town, so the hotels suffer.
At Tsubasaya, a restaurant near the Toyota train station, business began to fall right after March 11th, says owner Hironari Takanobu.
We had a lot of large reservations, and they were canceled after the disaster. People didn't want to spend money. Now fewer customers are coming in, and it hasn't gotten any better.
What makes the crisis especially challenging is how open-ended it is. Kiyohito Okuda expects to be at full production by the end of the month, but many other parts plants, especially those near the disaster zone, will take longer, and that's likely to have a ripple effect throughout the auto industry.
In order to make a car, all the parts have to be available. We can be at full production here, but if the plants in other areas are shut down and parts are missing, you can't make a car.
Okuda worries about how Toyota will respond if the crisis drags on. The danger for Toyota City is that the company will decide to protect itself from natural disasters by scattering parts production to more places. For a city so heavily dependent on the automaker, that would be a blow it might not recover from. Jim Zeroli, NPR News, Tokyo.